The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
President Zelensky praises Ireland's response to Ukraine but says we can do more. Is it time for an informed debate on Irish neutrality? Inflation or wage increases, which comes first? And will we be paying for two CMOs? We have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And it's Damien O'Reilly here with you until 11. And joining me in studio tonight, we have Christopher O'Sullivan, Fianna Fáil TD for Cork South West and party spokesperson for Climate Action, Biodiversity and Environment. Sorka Clark, Sinn Féin TD for Longford West Meath and party spokesperson for Defence. Paul Murphy, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South West. And Eoin O'Cahan, who is the political correspondent for Radio na Gaeltachta. We want to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can text us as usual on 51551. You can email us latedebate@rte.ie and you can tweet at latedebate.rte. Well, to Ukraine first this evening and reaction to President Zelensky's address to the joint houses of the Oireachtas earlier this morning. Let's begin by listening to a clip of his address given through an interpreter.
People of Ireland, since the very first days you are supporting good, you are supporting Ukraine, and this is a fact. You did not doubt starting helping us. You began doing this right away. And although you are a neutral country, you have not remained neutral to the disaster and to the mishaps that Russia has brought to Ukraine. I'm grateful to you, to every citizen of Ireland. Thank you for supporting sanctions against Russia.
Okay, so Eoin O'Cahan, can you sum up the speech for us, if possible? It was, what, about 10 or 15 minutes in duration?
Yeah, about 10 minutes this morning, starting at 10 a.m. It was interesting. Obviously, we could see President Zelensky. You could kind of see how pained his expression was, how tired he was. And I mean, as we've heard from the headlines and from the clip that you played there, there was a description of what has happened in Ukraine, the barbarism, as many of the politicians later mentioned, of what's happened over the weekend in particular. This, of course, being the weekend where we find out about the atrocities in Bucha and etc. There was an expression of gratitude towards Ireland, as we also heard there, towards the people of Ireland and towards the politicians in Ireland for their support, not only of the sanctions at European level, but also, I guess, for not remaining morally neutral and for acting very, very swiftly to come to Ukraine's aid and in the ways that we could. There was an acknowledgement that as Ireland is a military neutral country, that there were certain constraints placed upon it, but that there were other ways that Ireland worked to help Ukraine, and in particular the welcoming of refugees. That was mentioned by President Zelensky. And there was also kind of a request, I guess, to do more. And I think this has been the main message of Ukraine in the past few days. As the European Commission has announced its work on this fifth round of sanctions, as we've heard, there's been a ban on the import of Russian coal. The import of Russian gas and Russian oil remains, and that is, I mean, really what is funding the Russian war machine. And we heard President Zelensky, really request that Ireland do more to push for a ban on the import of these two energy sources at European level. Something that's going to be far more difficult because there are a number of countries that rely far more on Russian gas and on Russian oil. I think in particular Germany, that seems to be the one that's the crux of the case. But I guess the President Zelensky used this opportunity to address another European country to push for this and to really put the pressure, I think, on the government. And as I say, that was underlined with its description of what exactly has happened in Ukraine. I mean, he went into detail about the number of educational facilities that have been targeted, the civilian targets, the fact that there are people who were trying to escape Russian troops were killed, that people, were found with their hands tied behind their back, etc. I mean, it really went into detail. It was a very, very powerful and very moving speech, which I think left an impression on everyone in the room.
Okay, and there was some diplomacy there, obviously, in referencing our own history and comparisons to Ukraine, I know, as well. The running order after that were speeches from the various party leaders, beginning with the Taoiseach. What sort of a tone did they take on?
Well, I guess it was the Taoiseach, the Tánaiste, and Eamon Ryan speaking at first on behalf of the government, all, you know, expressing their steadfast support for Ukraine, their solidarity with Ukraine, acknowledging what they're going through, acknowledging the strength of the people, the strength of the president. I thought that it was interesting that the Taoiseach mentioned in particular the wish for Ukraine to be a European country, to be a member of the European Union. Support for that request also was expressed. It kind of went into a bit of theatrics then when you had Eamon Ryan, who was referencing the other people who had spoken in front of the joint houses of the Oireachtas. He referenced the JFK speech, I think, which was done obviously in the early 60s, and where he spoke about how Ireland would always, you know, work against or stand against tyranny, and that is what they are doing now. And there was also, I guess, there was a sense of gratitude again to the people of Ireland who've opened, I think as someone said, their hearts and in many cases their homes to Ukrainian refugees, something that I think it was said that, you know, this kind of references Irish history. We have experience of being, you know, under threat or being invaded, and that kind of saying we wouldn't expect anything less of the Irish people, but still acknowledging what is being done.
Yeah, as you say it there, historical, only the fifth time that a foreign leader has addressed the houses like that, but obviously in the first time in these specific circumstances. Paul Murphy, there's been a lot of focus on People Before Profit today, and the fact that at the end of President Zelensky's speech, you stood up, but you and your colleagues didn't clap. Listening to the response throughout the day on various radio programmes and from other politicians and commentators, did you misread the room? Do you regret now that you didn't partake in that regard?
No, the focus for us was on standing in solidarity with the Ukrainian people. So that's what we did. And that's what the focus should be on. That's what the news should be focused on, is the horror of the brutal, unjustifiable imperialist invasion by Russia of Ukraine. And then we were very clear in doing so because we wanted to express our solidarity and to say we're on the side of the Ukrainian people, and the Irish government needs to do more for the people of Ukraine. We need to do more in terms of humanitarian aid. The Irish government should come out in favour. So far, they've refused to, under pressure from us, come out in favour of the cancellation of Ukrainian debt, for example, over 7 billion euros worth of repayments this year. And we should shut down the shadow banking sector in this country, which would affect all sorts of oligarchs.
That wasn't really
what
it was about today, though, was it? That wasn't really what it was about. It was about listening to President Zelensky, obviously explaining the horrific situation which his people are actually going through, and looking for some sort of solidarity from the Irish people, which you talk about there, which is obviously our sympathies with him. But was this a premeditated protest? Did it matter what he was actually going to say? Had you made your minds up before you got in there, we're going to make a protest here?
When you say it's not what it was about, I'm saying this is about solidarity with Ukrainian people. That is what it was about. Yes. I think that's what ordinary people felt. And I think, and precisely, you started with saying that appeal for the Irish government to do more. We want the Irish government to do more for the people of
Ukraine. So why did the other members of the Oireachtas applaud then?
Okay, because we're not going to be disingenuous and applause for things we don't agree with. I mean, when Richard Boyd Barrett spoke, you know, most of the government TDs didn't clap, and that's fine and normal. That's no problem. They didn't agree with what he said, so they didn't applaud. Mm. And obviously there's a lot in what President Zelensky said that we did agree with, and we were moved by the horror and so on. But he did call for, the main thing that he was calling for was an extension of what are indiscriminate sanctions by EU against Russia. And we're not in favour of that, because we don't think that contributes towards ending the conflict. And we think that it is ordinary people in Russia who are paying the price of it now. And so we think the effect of it is to hit ordinary people. They're the same sort of sanctions that were applied on Iraq in the 1990s, responsible for the death of 500,000 children, which everyone now looks back and says, Jesus, that was terrible. It was then in the name of, against a horrific dictator, Saddam Hussein, and so on. But it was ordinary people who paid the price. Yeah. But also it's counterproductive in the sense that the anti-war movement in Russia is something to be really applauded and is an inspiration for all of us around the world. But actually, it's helping Putin to isolate the anti-war movement. His approval ratings have unfortunately gone up in the conflict because he's able to say, this is the West, all of the West is simply against us, and he's able to paint those people as fifth columnists.
Okay, and I want to bring Sorka and Christopher in, but just one other question. You talk about you're against the sanctions because it is going to affect ordinary Russian people. What evidence do you have that that is actually happening?
That's the evidence from news reporters on the ground. I mean, what the French finance minister said, we're going to wage total economic and financial war and the most heaviest sanctions that have ever been seen. Remember, this is a world that had those sanctions on Iraq. This is about crippling the Russian economy. It is war by other means. And who pays the price for war? Who's paying the price for war in Ukraine? Obviously, in the most horrific way, with their lives, with deliberate targeting of civilians and so on. It's ordinary people who pay the price. And that is who's paying it. You don't see oligarchs going hungry, going homeless as a consequence.
Well, I see Roman Abramovich is looking for his mates to help him out to the tune of $1 million each, apparently, this evening, because he has no money. Christopher Sullivan.
Yeah, first of all, just to touch on today's events, extraordinary. That will live long in my memory. I'm a TD now for 2 years, and that was certainly the most memorable event and most extraordinary event that we've had. The fact that we have, in 2022, the leader of a European democracy addressing the joint Oireachtas to the Dáil Chamber, pleading for help, looking for help. I didn't think it would happen in 2022, yet here we are. It's absolutely extraordinary. And when you think of the speakers that we've had before that were just referenced, John F. Kennedy, Bill Clinton, Speaker Pelosi, Nelson Mandela, this has to rank right up there in importance. In fact, it's probably even more important because it's a wartime leader in a bunker, you know, in a country that's been invaded.
Did we learn anything today we didn't really know already?
Yeah, I think we did, in that we've learned the lengths of disrespect that people before profit are willing to enter into when a leader of a country comes
in.
Well,
apart from that, no, I'm just talking about President Zelensky and the situation in Ukraine. I mean, as Owen said earlier on, he looked tired. He has obviously addressed the UN. He's addressed the EU. Why did he have to take time out this morning to address all of you guys, to give you these special memories?
Because he knows that Ireland, we're a small nation, but we're a powerful nation, and people listen to us, and that we have, I suppose, a voice within Europe. And there were some very simple asks he had of us today to increase sanctions and be harder in terms of the sanctions that we impose in Europe, on Russia as Europe. And there was that very important plea, which is acknowledged by the Taoiseach, and the Taoiseach will support, and that is their application for membership of the EU. And that was a very, very important point for him to get across to both.
Okay, so you agree with that. Paul Murphy disagrees with some aspects of what he had to say. Isn't he entitled as an elected politician, as a people before profit politician, to stand by his convictions and not applaud without getting all the abuse that he and his colleagues have received all day since?
He's absolutely entitled to his opinion. And, you know, it's completely fine. And there's no problem with Paul or people before profit discussing or highlighting issues, perhaps with the conduct of the US in other conflicts around the world. That's absolutely fine. But I think when a leader of a country addresses your House of Parliament, the House of Democracy, and appeals for help and outlines the atrocities that were happening in places like Mariupol and Bucha, torture, murder.
Okay.
And to compare that, this is important. I feel like, you know, an applause is a very powerful gesture. Yes, you can say that you stood in solidarity with the people of Ukraine, but an applause is a powerful gesture. And to say that the reason you're not doing it is because you feel the sanctions will have an impact on the people of Russia, you cannot compare the impact of sanctions, Paul, with the impact of the torture, the murder, and the war crimes being carried out by Russia in
Ukraine. All right, now let Paul respond, Sorka Clark, what was your, I suppose, analysis of the day's events? Obviously, first of all, the address, and I suppose the discussion that's happened all day since, about which we should be talking about the speech, but a lot of the discussion all afternoon since then and all morning has been about People Before Profit and the stance they took.
I'm not going to lie and say I agree with the stance People Before Profit took, but I recognise their right to do so. What struck me today, and actually before President Zelensky had even come onto the screen, was that there was a very young girl sitting in the chamber. I'd say she was maybe 5 or 6, small, young little girl sitting at the back that was there. And when you see somebody of that age in a parliament, and she was incredibly well behaved, as I say that as a parent whose children would not be well behaved if they were in that room. But what really struck me is that is the age group that we're talking about, that are walking miles upon miles to get out of the way of being bombarded by missiles and bombs from a very, very powerful neighbour. And that to me really struck home. But I have to say, I really agree with what Owen said there. I was somewhat taken back when I seen President Zelensky on the screen. He does look incredibly tired and he does look incredibly worn. And it's clear that not only are the actions to date taking a severe toll on
did he
the
really
country,
need
but
to
also
have
on
to address
himself.
The Dáil
I
and
think he did,
Shannon today?
And I think it's very important that he did, because for me what it signified wasn't the length of time that he had been there or the length of time that he spoke, but it was that show of solidarity that he is expressing outwards as well as asking to be expressed inwards into the Ukraine. Like it, what he spoke of, I mean, yes, it was raw and it was harrowing and it was absolutely heartbreaking to see those vicious war crimes that are being rained down on the innocent civilians of the Ukraine. But that brutalisation really does make more of an impact when it's the president of a country that is putting it to the parliament of another country and asking very forthright for support and asking very forthright for help and recognising the actions that Ireland has taken to date, particularly around humanitarian aid.
Did his tone change a little bit from last week?
In terms of...
Well, when he said we could do more...
I think that may have been slightly misinterpreted as well. Now, in fairness, the definitely was picked up, okay. But I think it may have been misinterpreted. But the one thing that I took away from today was that these human rights violations, and these are grave, grave breaches of the Geneva Convention, these need to be investigated by the International Criminal Court. And we need to hold Russia responsible at some point for these actions.
Paul Murphy, do you agree with that?
I think it's a question of, yeah, but what? What needs to be done? What's the best thing that can be done? And that's where, like, we don't think sanctions are going to help. And it isn't at all to say it's the same. It's not the same as being, like, killed, as being executed when you're an innocent civilian.
We know Putin doesn't do dialogue either. So what's the other option?
Many dictators in the past haven't done dialogue and have found themselves overthrown. And so assisting the Russian anti-war movement in every single way that can be done.
Yeah, but there's 15,000 people in jail at the moment as a result of protesting on the streets.
Absolutely heroic to be doing it. So what we need to do is to be consistent, to say no to the imperialist aggression by Russia, to be absolutely opposed to it. And in order for that to be strong on the world stage, that has to be consistently applied. Mm-hmm. So, for example, what are we now going to do about Saudi Arabia? Leo Varadkar not only didn't impose sanctions on Saudi Arabia, Leo Varadkar was on a trade mission to Saudi Arabia just a few months ago. The DAA, the state-owned company formerly Dublin Airport Authority, won a contract last week to operate 4 airports in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is waging a war which has been ongoing for years on the people of Yemen, which is responsible for taking the lives of almost 400,000 people, committing war crimes.
Yeah, so Christopher Sullivan,
where is that?
Have we double standards going on here? We're willing to go out to Saudi Arabia and sell them our milk and our whatever else we can trade with them. And yet here we are obviously imposing sanctions on Russia.
No, there aren't double standards, and
really?
the conflict in Yemen has been criticised widely, certainly by people of my party. But I want to come back to something that Paul said there about activism within Russia. And I have to single out, there were some very powerful responses today from some of our political leaders in the chamber. I'll have to single out the Kion Korla's response. It was very statesmanlike and very diplomatic, and he did appeal to those Russians who weren't in favour of this war. And there are many that they would rise up and take action. And I'd agree with Paul on that, that we have to acknowledge the anti-war activism that is happening within Russia. And I thought as well, the Taoiseach's response was very powerful in terms of speaking to the people, the Ukrainians in Ireland, and saying that, you know, our home is your home and we hope you find refuge here. So, you know, Ireland is very good at humanitarian aid. That's where our strengths lie.
Okay.
And that's what we need to focus on.
All right. Well, you referenced the Kion Korla there, Seán O'Farrill. Here's what he had to say.
Most of us here in this chamber became involved in politics and public life because we trust in people and we believe that most people, are fundamentally good. Last Tuesday at the Conference of Speakers of the European Parliaments in Ljubljana, I called upon the members of the Duma, the 450 members of the Duma, to shoulder their responsibility. The law of averages would suggest that amongst the 450 members of that parliament, There must be people who can see through the lies, the fake news, the propaganda and the manipulation, and they must now find their courage, courage that the Ukrainian people demonstrate on a daily basis. They must speak up, speak out, take their courage and reject the leadership that they currently have.
So, Paul Murphy, I suppose you're in total agreement with what the Count Coerl is saying there.
Absolutely. I also think there is a point when we're talking about what's happening in Ukraine, which hasn't been discussed much in Ireland, and was a factor in terms of not applauding for President Zelensky, is that 2 weeks ago, the government act in Ukraine to ban 11 opposition parties, which between them have almost 20% of the vote. These are right-wing parties, some of which with links to Russian oligarchs. So they're not parties that we would generally agree with or have common cause with. But those we would, socialists in Ukraine who we work with, trade unionists, are opposed to that because they say, one, it's a restriction on people's basic democratic rights and that has worrying implications for the future. But two, because it also actually undermines the struggle against Russia. If you say to 20% of the population, well, the parties you voted for, who did oppose the invasion, to be clear, that they're not legitimate, they're not legitimate choices. You know, so if we were in Ukraine, just to be clear, we would be taking up arms to oppose and attempt to repel the Russian invader. But it doesn't mean we'd be voting for President Zelensky. And we continue to have political disagreements.
Well, he's gone, I think, from 20% to 90% popularity now at this stage. And certainly he is seen as, you know, a dedicated leader who's obviously united his country and has obviously enthralled the world in that regard. Would you agree, Sorka, that President Zelensky has actually...
He has managed to do something that the EU has struggled with for a long time, and that was the issue of refugees. And for once, we actually hear the EU speaking in a single voice that this is action that needs to be taken. But when I do agree with Christopher when he commends the Count Coerl for the words that he spoke. They were very powerful. But we have to remember and need to look at this in context. The national media coverage in Russia, we cannot presume to be the same coverage that we would accept as normal here. There's one national radio or television station that's there. So we also need to recognise that fierce curtailment that exists around the freedom of expression in Russia would place somebody in physical danger and physical harm for speaking out against the regime that's currently in power. That's not to say that there isn't people who oppose Putin and the actions that he's taken.
So do you think sanctions are the best option at this point in time?
Well, as Mary Lou MacDonald said earlier on this afternoon, it is Russia who has closed the door to diplomatic relations. It is them who has severed that tie. Now, we would hope and we would expect at some point to get back to that position. But is that what's on the table at the moment?
Okay,
there is nothing to evidence that there is. But when we speak about sanctions, there is a demand to increase them substantially as we move forward. Particularly around, you know, the coal has been banned, but around that fifth round of sanctions. Now, Sinn Féin has been speaking about for a considerable length of time the Section 110s and the IFSC and how that's been utilised by several Russian entities. And that's something that should have stopped not only a long time ago, but that needs to stop and as a matter of urgency now.
There will be more financial institutions and more finance brought within that bracket in terms of the sanctions, from what I understand. But we do have some very, very difficult decisions to make now, both as a country in Ireland and in the EU. Tougher sanctions, I would certainly support and condone sanctions and stopping that flow of that half a billion that goes to Russia every day for Russian oil and gas. I think that has to come to an end. It's going to put us under pressure. We're going to probably have a conversation about the cost of living later on. But that half a billion is funding war, and we need to stop it. And that is a
okay,
sanction.
Paul, would you agree with that in terms of buying energy from Russia? Are they the sanctions you're talking about? To get a definition, when we talk about the sanctions that you're against, what exactly are you against? What sort of sanctions are you against? Do you think we should still be spending all that money on buying oil, gas, coal from Russia?
Look, I mean, I think we need to stop buying fossil fuels altogether from Russia, from Saudi Arabia, from the US, for both environmental and humanitarian reasons. I'm against the collective punishment of the Russian people, which is really what broad-based, indiscriminate sanctions represent. And when you have a commodity-based economy like Russia, these sort of sanctions...
Can you give me examples of the sanctions you're
talking
about? Of the sanctions you're talking about, which you're against, which you say are hurting the ordinary people of Russia.
the ones that are trying to crush the Russian economy. So stopping buying the commodities that are coming from Russia are trying to crush the Russian economy. And unfortunately, while I'd be perfectly okay with the oligarchs being, you know, bankrupted, I'm in favour of bankrupting, I'm in favour of expropriating the assets of the Russian oligarchs and all the oligarchs of the world in reality.
Would you agree with the freezing of their assets?
Sure, yeah. I agree with the freezing of their assets. But things that hurt ordinary people, what that is a collective punishment of ordinary people who are not responsible for the actions of Putin. We understand it's effectively a dictatorial
society. We've ruled out diplomacy, we've ruled out dialogues. You're ruling out sanctions. We've talked about the difficulty of people speaking out because of the regime and the propaganda. How do you bring this conflict to an end?
Yeah, so I think what Ireland should do is, one, we should increase humanitarian aid immediately. We've given 20 million so far. We should do more than that. Two, and it would have an immediate impact if Ireland, a country, is on the UN Security Council, came out and said, we're in favour of a cancellation of Ukrainian debt. It is crippling the Ukrainian economy. It is having an impact on their ability to fight this war, and it is going to have a huge impact on their ability to rebuild the country after the war, hoping that Ukraine still exists as a contiguous state and so on. So Ireland come out in doing that. And I think actually moving on the shadow banking that's happening in the IFSC, there's a really interesting article by Brian O'Boyle in the journal.ie today explaining how the shadow banking in the IFSC is used by the Russian oligarchs. Well, let's shut that down for all the oligarchs. That would actually, there'd be real things that would have an impact on the world state.
I want to move on, but I just want to bring a couple of texts that have come in. Sarah Delaney says, Nelson Mandela said that there was no doubt that sanctions helped bring an end to apartheid in South Africa. Somebody else says, fair play to Paul Murphy. We need people brave enough to analyse and think independently. And someone else says, to compare what is happening to the people of Ukraine to sanctions on Russia is disgusting. And that's according to Mary. Owen, back to you. The Taoiseach re-emphasised what he has said before about the country not being politically neutral. I know the Count Corla made reference to it today as well about us being militarily neutral but not politically. And I believe President Higgins and indeed the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, was on the 6-1 this evening. They've touched on the neutrality question. What have they been saying?
Yes, exactly. I think the neutrality question has really come up today after the President Zelensky's address. Simon Coveney said that perhaps the war in Ukraine should be a catalyst for an honest rethink about Ireland's security and defence policies. I think a lot of people were surprised to hear President Michael D. Higgins. I mean, in fact, TDs that I was speaking to this evening were kind of, you know, almost in awe of the comments that Michael D. Higgins made, somebody who has often protested against war. He was speaking, interestingly enough, in Austria, one of the five European Union countries that are military neutral, and said that perhaps they need to, there should be an informed debate about neutrality, one that should be respectful, and that perhaps they should start a dialogue. I think, again, it's interesting, I guess. I think, you know, some people might accuse certain political parties and certain ideologies of perhaps taking advantage of the war in Ukraine to discuss Ireland's neutrality, Ireland's position on this, Ireland's membership in NATO, etc. I think the government is very, very quick to say that, you know, while they remain military neutral, they're not politically nor morally neutral, and that has been exhibited in their response to the Ukraine crisis and in the support indeed of the sanctions at EU level. But I thought it was again interesting even today to hear Cathal Berry, an independent TD, one who has of course a background in the Defence Forces, talk about the need or the possibility that Ireland might send some of the weapons that we have in the Curragh over to Ukraine, that this might be of help. I noted that Paul actually was sitting behind Cathal when he was speaking today in the Dáil, and that I'm not sure. It received quite a frosty reception from Paul Murphy, but maybe he can go into that later on himself.
It's always difficult to get the impressions when they have their masks on. What's going on underneath? So
I think I might have seen an eye roll, but I might be wrong. Maybe we can discuss that in a bit. But I think, I mean, there was, I thought it was interesting that there was a smattering of applause for Cathal Berry when he finished speaking today. I mean, I was talking to some government TDs who described him as being a very well able and a very capable speaker, and that, you know, that perhaps there should be some thought given to what he was suggesting. I mean, I've heard other government representatives kind of scoff at the idea, to say kind of the equipment that we might have wouldn't be of much use, and that it's not a serious idea. But I think it shows how much the conversation has moved on, that this is now being opened openly discussed in the Dáil chamber, something that would have been, I think, taboo before. I mean, I know even from my experience before, especially when in European elections, I mean, there was always the spectre raised of a European army. There was a poll recently that showed that support for Irish participation in such in a European defence programme has actually risen. So again, I suppose because of the emergency that we're seeing and because of what we are being shown from Ukraine, because of addresses like we heard today from President Zelensky, I think Irish people are more aware of our role when it comes to European defence, and perhaps there is an opinion being changed there across the public at large.
All right. Can I ask you, Sir? I'll probably get a different answer from all three of you. Will you define what is Irish neutrality?
Well, this is the funny thing about Irish neutrality in the sense that it's not funny in any way, shape or form. But most people are under the illusion that our neutrality is enshrined in our constitution. Mm-hmm. It isn't. Yeah. There's an understanding that it's enshrined in some form of legislation. It isn't. It's a policy. And that fact often takes people back. But when we look at our neutrality, yes, we are what's called militarily non-aligned. We are somewhat of an outlier in terms of Europe specifically. There's a number of different forms of neutrality. We seem to have made one all for ourselves. That's nowhere between the other ones. But what we see time and time again when we speak of neutrality, and I hear this, and as a spokesperson for defence, what I hear is that what successive governments have failed to do is actually invest in air neutrality, because neutrality in certain contexts can give the impression of being inactive. That's not what neutrality is at all.
If we sent whatever's below in the Curra over to Ukraine,
I don't think that's a viable option.
But would we be no longer neutral?
That's exactly what would happen. And it's not a viable option for a number of reasons. And we also heard recently the Taoiseach speaking about removing the triple lock. And I would have very, very serious concerns.
Will you explain to our listeners, what is the triple lock?
OK, so it's a three voting system that needs to go through before Irish Army or Irish military can take place and participate in certain actions. But the reason why I would have such serious concerns about it is because what we would essentially be doing is jeopardising any future role that we would have in peacekeeping missions. Air neutrality and our peacekeeping role has been a significant contributing factor to us securing the seat in the UN Security Council. So air neutrality is what we're known for. They're often referred to as the blueberries. We are seen as being that impartial voice, to being that impartial actor in certain arenas that can help to broker peace and to ensure peace maintains. But in relation to NATO, and it was touched on briefly there, I mean, anybody who has read the recent report into the Commission on the Future of the Defence Forces, when you really get down into the nuts and bolts of that, the question that before we even start talking about joining NATO would NATO even have us? Because of the underinvestment that has been so significant. So even if you were of the disposition to it be in favour of Ireland joining NATO, there's a very good chance that NATO wouldn't even accept us because
the Baltic countries are members, and they obviously came from a background of I suppose relative poverty after the breakup of the Soviet Union as well. But Finland and Sweden, they're neutral as well, but yet they're sending arms, I understand, to Ukraine, and they're still defined as neutral.
Yes, but you have to look at their actual political system as to what their neutrality is defined in. We have, as I said, made this almost third version of neutrality uniquely for ourselves.
I think Ger Crockwell, I heard him on News Talk recently describing it as paddy neutrality is what we have in this country.
That's very disrespectful.
He's a man that knows quite a lot about the whole area of Irish neutrality. He was in a debate with Richard Boyd Barrett on it recently. Christopher O'Sullivan, what is your interpretation of Irish neutrality?
I was just about to say our neutrality is enshrined in our constitution. No, I'm only messing. I wasn't going to say that. But similar to what President Hagan said today, I do welcome an informed, intelligent debate on it. I think we should have informed, intelligent debates on a lot of things. And certainly neutrality is another one of those things. But the way Taoiseach describes our neutrality is positive neutrality. And that is being impartial actors and peace brokers. But also I firmly believe that we should stick to what we are good at and what we have been good at for decades, and that
would you send arms,
humanitarian
to
aid? For example, I don't agree with what Cathal Berry said today. Okay. Cathal has respect right across the both houses of the Oireachtas. He's an incredibly nice guy as well, but I wouldn't, because it does essentially jeopardise our neutrality, the neutrality that we have at the moment. I'm sure that my opinion isn't shared by everybody in government. I think people have different opinions, which is why I would welcome an informed debate on it, but I think we should stick to what we're good at. opening our doors to people. I mean, the effort, the voluntary effort on the ground in communities right across Ireland to accommodate Ukrainian refugees is phenomenal. That is our strength and we should stick to it.
Okay, Paul Murphy, will you define Irish neutrality?
Yeah, well, we attempted to define Irish neutrality and to put it in the Constitution just last week with a bill calling for an informed debate, ending up with the people deciding in a referendum. Unfortunately, the government voted it down because they want to have a very managed debate whereby they've always wanted to get rid of neutrality, which I'll define in a second. And now they see their chance, unfortunately, very cynically.
Do we need a citizens' assembly on it?
I mean, fine, let's have a citizens' assembly, but let's have a commitment that we're going to have a referendum. So what we tried to define neutrality in the Constitution as is no participation in military alliances, no participation in armed conflict unless Ireland is attacked, and no use of Ireland's land, ports and so on, for the transport of war material for the purpose of armed conflict, and no participation in the process of European militarisation. And the point I'm making about the political establishment, in particular Fine Gael, have seen neutrality as a straitjacket and the triple lock as a straitjacket to be done away with for a long time. You go back to 2004, they had a policy document, Fine Gael did, called Beyond Neutrality, which described the triple lock in those terms, which explicitly said, we want to go beyond neutrality. They have chipped away and away and away at it between the use of Shannon Airport for over 2.5 million US soldiers to go to the Middle East to engage in imperialist wars of aggression there, responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. The participation in Ireland in PESCO, the participation in Ireland in the EU battle groups. And now the latest is Simon Coveney is saying, oh, we very likely will participate in these kind of supersized EU battle groups, which would be called the European Reaction Force. Micheál Martin has repeated neutrality is a policy which can be changed at any time. And I think they would like to entirely do away with neutrality, align Ireland more definitively and clearly and openly with NATO behind the backs of ordinary people. Because I don't think people would agree with that. I don't think people think we should spend huge amounts of money.
We can't really cherry pick what parts of the EU we want to be part of and what parts we don't want to be part of.
Well, we were told we could, actually. That was the whole purpose of voting on Lisbon Treaty the second time. We got a guarantee to say, don't worry, you won't be participating in this European militarisation whatsoever. Okay. We got an entire protocol saying that we could cherry pick it.
Okay, I want to read some text. Neutrality does not mean getting involved using weapons or personnel. Defending a country under persecution is entirely legitimate as a neutral country. That's from John Moy in Athenry. Being neutral in Ireland is being used as an excuse to stand by and do nothing, says another texter. And one other text, what neutrality we gave support to US troops heading to their wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Okay, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with more on The Late Debate after these.
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
Well, the other big issue occupying our minds is most definitely the cost of living. And Owen, the central bank were out today to talk about inflation, wages and where we're going in that regard. What did they have to say?
Well, the central bank today has revised its forecasts when it comes to growth in the economy. It said that this year inflation could peak at 8%, will average out at 6.5%. I guess none of this will come really as anything new to anyone who's been following politics. There's been a lot of talk about the rising rate of inflation. We've received warnings now from political leadership that what was originally thought that would be very short-lived will in fact be more long-term. This isn't a phenomenon that's unique to Ireland. The same thing is being said across Europe, in particular as a result of the war in Ukraine, of the knock-on effect that will have on energy prices. And also, I think it's something that we've seen in the US. There's been a lot of talk about how quickly the inflation rate has gone. It's sped up, really. Something that was a bit worrying today was that Deutsche Bank was become the first US financial institution to predict a recession for 2023, 2024. And perhaps this is something that we might see across other financial institutions. This isn't being, the central bank hasn't come out and expressed that just yet, that we're due a recession in Ireland. But I think it is worrying. And I thought it was also interesting today, we had Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, the Minister for Finance, the Minister for Public Expenditure, who presented the quarter one results. Again, I mean, the exchequer figures which showed that the tax revenues were, you know, far higher than they were last year. But there was a number of caveats and a number of kind of, you know, explanations thrown in to say, you know, while things might look very, very positive now, that there, you know, there are a number of hurdles that we still have to cross, or still have to, you know, to jump over, and that all mightn't be so rosy as we continue on the year. So whereas revenue might look good now, it might look at the economy is going from strength to strength, but there are a number of, there are a number of hurdles that remain there, the inflation rate being one.
Yeah, and Sorcagh Clark, I mean, it is a difficult square to circle in this regard, that obviously people say, well, rising inflation requires people obviously maybe to be paid more to be able to make ends meet. But then when you increase wages, you increase inflation and it just spirals like that. Do you understand it's a very delicate situation that we're in at the moment in that regard? Or do we need to re-engage with the social partners on wage increases?
Well, what I understand is that the cost of living crisis started well before Russia invaded the Ukraine. However, there is now a deliberate effort to shift the narrative away from that fact to the illegal invasion of Ukraine causing this rise in cost of living. That's not the case. It has absolutely compounded it. It is going to continue to compound it and it will continue to impact on it, but it is not the cause of it. Now, what we see also at this point is, yes, like inflation is reducing the value of wages. I mean, as the average of 6.5%. So without a pay increase, workers are essentially working. They are donating back in 6.5% of their wages. That's what it means, because your euro isn't going as far as what it is. We have seen energy prices, home heating oil, motor fuel, rents, food is now starting to creep up as well. And that absolutely will be impacted by the Ukraine. But what we don't see is any meaningful action coming from government. And I would not be at all surprised if we start seeing demands for wages increases across the board. The Financial Services Union, yep, absolutely. ICTU apparently have advised members to seek pay rises. RTE, no doubt, will have the unions on the phone seeking pay rises as well. Because you have to remember, the vast, vast majority of workers in this country have not received a pay rise since before the pandemic.
But as we heard last week, the government can't keep writing cheques either. And they have written a cheque for almost €1 billion in terms of energy supports. Mm-hmm. So you can't say that they're not doing anything. And a lot of these issues in terms of the cost of living, it's outside, it has been outside our control. Would you agree with that? Even before the Ukraine invasion?
Some of them have, but government cannot insulate households from the full impact of the change in economic environment. But what they absolutely can do is not compound the problem. And what they absolutely can do is support workers and families in meeting those bills. But I just want to finish on this, if I can. When we talk about pay rises and pay engagement, what really is important here is that workers engage in collective bargaining. And where there is a collective bargaining method in place and there's engagement with the employer, if it is a case that the employer says that they don't have the financial resources to meet those things, there is another mechanism there where through the Workplace Relations Commission that both parties can go to. And if it is a case when the employer opens their books that they cannot meet the demands that's been asked, well, then further negotiations can take place.
And I'm sure that's the case.
But to write off pay increases at this point, in my mind, it's far too early. Yeah. There needs to be engagement with collective
bargaining. Because there will be a lot of small to medium enterprises and family businesses that are just getting back on their feet after 2 years that are, you know, employing two or three people that are now quaking this evening, saying, now am I going to be subject to having to pay my staff more money
really
I don't
profoundly
have.
Profoundly impacted. Yeah. And I see this very much in my own constituency, which would be predominantly rural. But also remember as well, Jim, like what we've seen as well recently is that public sector pay deal talks are due to start at the end of the month. The current one runs till the end of the year, but there has been a clause triggered in that where it could be reviewed if the economic environment has changed substantially, and has changed substantially. Okay. So they are due to get underway as well.
Okay, Christopher Sullivan.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think Sorka seems to be laying the raising inflation squarely at the feet of government, which
no,
I think
just
is completely
cost of living.
Unfair. Prior to the war of Ukraine, you're right, there was inflation rises, there was cost of living issues. But prior to the invasion of Ukraine, we had a pandemic for 2 years, which impacted on supply chain. So we have to acknowledge that as well. You also said that the government has done nothing in order to address the cost of living.
And with all due respect,
since the budget,
but
sorry,
the cost of childcare has nothing whatsoever
budget,
to do with Russian invasion.
Okay, let Chris answer, just respond.
Since the budget, we've provided €2 million in tax and expenditure. €1 billion since the budget as well. €200 in a credit for energy bills. €125 extra on top of fuel allowance. Fuel allowance has increased since we've come into government from €600 to over €1,000. In the last budget, Sinn Féin's proposed increase in fuel loans was zero. We increased it by 5 euros. So we've actually put these measures in place.
And this is
there will be more measures. And sorry, I haven't finished yet.
But do you need that 200 euro off your electricity bill? We've also reduced
excise duty, 15 cent on the price of diesel and 20 cent on the price of petrol. So to say that we've done nothing, to say that we've stood by, is absolutely ridiculous. And I also note your opposition to the carbon tax. And Sorka, whether you like it or not, carbon tax and the increase in carbon tax will be one of the most meaningful ways that we can address fuel poverty, because carbon tax is ring-fenced for retrofitting. Yeah. It's ring-fenced for a warmer home scheme, which is 100%
people that are vulnerable and all
to keep houses
and
warm.
Has there been some opposition this evening at the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting to the decision by the government to offset some of that? Or they what's the feeling within Fianna Fáil?
There wasn't any opposition to offsetting the
but is the feeling in the is there what would the collective feeling in Fianna Fáil be? Would it be to continue and certainly continue on with the carbon tax?
Yeah, we had a good debate today on carbon tax and the impact of carbon tax. And obviously, it was in the context of the cost of living, in the context of the fact that, yes, absolutely, families, individuals are struggling. We're as public reps, we're all getting in the neck. We're all hearing about the struggles that families and individuals are having in terms of paying their bills. But there was a good debate had. But yes, we formed the opinion that carbon tax and the increase in carbon tax was important. And it's really important to outline why it's important. It's because it is the funding ring fence from carbon tax that funds the retrofitting, that funds the warmer home scheme, that funds the fuel allowance, which is really important, and helps targeted measures to help the least well off and lower income earners. Sinn Féin, I'm not sure whether you're for or against carbon tax in your budgets. You always budget for carbon tax, but when an increase in carbon tax comes up, you always oppose it. You're completely...
Well, let's sort of come back in.
Why was there such a delay in the government approaching the European Commission to pass on a VAT break on ESB bills? We have been asking for this for months. I think Pascal Donoghue said that he had actually only wrote to the European Commission 3 weeks ago.
That conversation has already started, and I absolutely agree with you. I think they're the measures that we have to have. We have to look at VAT. We have to look at reduction in VAT. We have to look at excise duties. I absolutely agree with you there. But targeting carbon tax, which is the one tax that is actually ring-fenced for measures to help prevent
poverty. What is the average turnaround and the average payback time on a family putting solar panels on the roof of their home?
Oh, well, we're going down a completely different road now getting back to the specifics about inflation and how we tackle it, and wage increases, that's just fighting fire with fire. Paul Murphy.
Yeah, if workers don't organise and put in claims and win claims higher than the rate of inflation, they're
9% wage increases.
They're receiving pay cuts. That's the SRI said that very, very bluntly today. You know what you can buy with your wage at the end of the week will be reduced unless you're able to organise. But what does that do to inflation then? Well, it depends on where that comes from. That's the truth. And a very important point that isn't part of the conversation at all is the fact that big business and energy companies in particular are announcing record profits. Mm. Record profits. So they are choosing not to eat any of the cost of the increased cost, for example, of oil and gas, but simply to pass it all on. Others are choosing to take advantage of this moment to try and increase their profits even further.
But when you talk about a nine...
eat into those profits.
Sure.
And that's where the wages can come from. But also we could have a windfall tax, for example, on the super profits being made by energy companies this year.
But what about the vast majority of businesses in this country that are not that big, that are not making big profits, that are employing 3, 4, 5 people, particularly in the hospitality sector, for example? What are you saying to them? Yes, go pay your staff 9% more when they're just coming out of a pandemic?
Well, I mean, look at the hospitality sector. That's a low-wage sector. It really is. A low-wage, high-stress sector. And yes, I think workers in that sector deserve a decent wage. I think they deserve and need to survive at least 15 euros an hour. I think that's the kind of minimum wage. Can I just make a more general point on the cost of living?
Yeah, no one briefly. There are other
things that the government can and should do. Rent. I mean, rent is a huge proportion of people's costs. It continues to soar. We should have a rent freeze immediately, and in reality, we should have rent reductions across the board. Okay. We should have the provision of free public services, free public transport.
Okay. I mean, Why can't we do that? Didn't touch on the salary issue. Look, I think the market is going to drive an increase in salaries in the private sector anyway, and I do believe that there will be discussion and dialogue, social dialogue with unions, with employers around increased cost of wages, because the gap between inflation and wages is going to be so large that it's essentially going to be a net loss in salary. So I imagine that conversation will happen.
Will happen, okay. Carbon tax does not help us renters. That comes in there from one texter as well. And Patrick Doyle in Glasnevin says, the cost of living will only affect ordinary people. We'll get great speeches on tightening our belts and we're all in this together from the government when really the poor are on their own. That's an email from Patrick in Glasnevin. Oh, and just, we don't have much time, but Tony Holohan is still in the news.
Tony Holohan is indeed still in the news, and there's a lot of talk about this secondment, this new role that he's about to take with Trinity College. I guess there's been a number of, how will I put it diplomatically, eyebrows raised about the circumstances around which this appointment has been made. First and foremost, I have to say that everyone I spoke to today, government TD and otherwise, have said that, you know, they appreciate the work that Tony Holohan has done, and that they, you know, they wish him the best. And they, I mean, he's done the state a lot of service, etc. But
Stephen Donnelly was on the radio this morning, and then Mark McSharry made reference to it in the Dáil, am I right?
Mark McSharry did indeed. I think anyone who has the honour to cover politics in Ireland will appreciate Mark McSharry's forthrightness in sharing his opinions, and he did so on social media this morning. When Minister Donnelly was on Morning Ireland, he described it as total waffle and nonsense. Then he took the opportunity again to raise it during questions on promised legislation, where it was described as an embarrassment. And it was just a criticised, let's say, very strongly by Mark
McSherry. To put it in context, Rachel English asked the minister if we are going to be paying effectively now for two CMOs. He said no, but obviously the Department of Health is going to be funding his secondment, his new role in Trinity College. Yeah. Is that at the nub of it?
Exactly. So Dr. Tony Holohan is moving to Trinity to take up this professorship role, but he's going to continue to be paid by the HSE. And this is something that when the Taoiseach was asked yesterday, I think it was Paul Hosford from the Irish Examiner asked him, he said that he didn't know anything about it. Again, when Michael McGrath was asked about it, it seemed that there was no knowledge. This wasn't signed off by the relevant government minister. And again, when Stephen Donnelly was speaking on Morning Ireland, it seemed to be that the decision was already made. This didn't come from ministerial. And I think that's ultimately what has annoyed a number of government TDs, and that there, again, that the eyebrows have been raised about this. Who exactly made the decision, and why did it seem that the government was caught unaware when questions, very basic questions about who's going to be paying the salary, were asked. Okay. And I think that's where we are.
All right. We just have a couple of minutes left and I want to get a reaction, Sorkel Clark, not necessarily to Stephen Donnelly this morning, but just to this idea that Tony Holohan's new role, and we wish him very well in his new job, but it is actually going to be funded by the Department of Health.
I find this whole scenario really very unusual. I mean, this is public money, and when one is on secondment, one presumes one has a job to go back to. So is he leaving the role? Is he not leaving the role? Is the new CMO coming in for a certain length of time? We've been told that he stepped down from his post, that he's not going to be returning, and yet we have contradictory statements being made by the minister. Now, I don't know of anybody who's on an open-ended secondment, and I also don't see why it is, if he has left the role to take up this new job in Trinity, which I think actually has merit in fairness, why the Department of Health are continuing to pay his salary.
All right, 30 seconds each, Paul and Christopher.
Yeah, I mean, Trinity should clearly pay him. Clearly the public should not be paying for two CMOs at the same time.
Well, he won't be the CMO. Well, he's in a new
that's,
role.
But that's the point. We're paying for two CMOs. We're not getting two CMOs. We're getting one CMO, and we're paying for someone to do something else. And clearly no ordinary worker in any ordinary job would have this option open. So it does beg questions. I mean, when did Stephen Donnelly know about this? Did he sign off on it and then just not tell the rest of the government?
Christopher Sullivan, embarrassing for the government?
No, not embarrassing, but I do agree with Paul and Sorkin in that you know, the role itself absolutely has merit. It's an important role. Public health is really important going forward. I struggle to understand why the HSE are paying on the double here and Trinity aren't paying the wage. It certainly raises eyebrows and needs clarity. I think Minister McGrath did say that he would try to get clarity on the whole process.
All right, back after this.
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.